News. Iran's lead delegate to nuclear talks in Vienna says a final agreement depends on how much the US and European sides are prepared to adjust themselves with the legitimate demands of the Islamic Republic. Opposition leader Yair Lapid says he has forged a coalition that could end Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year rule. Also ahead, the World Health Organization says nearly 200,000 Palestinians are in need of health aid following the recent Israeli onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Iran's lead delegate to nuclear talks in Vienna says a final agreement depends on how much the US and European sides are prepared to adjust themselves with the legitimate demands of the Islamic Republic. Abbas Araghchi says the talks are not close to the point of reaching a deal. Pamelezki reports.
The fifth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA concludes in Vienna. The objective, to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure the full implementation of Iran's nuclear commitments. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the sticking points are fewer than they were a week ago.
It's a complex process with political decisions, with rather technical issues. They go in parallel. Now we are reaching a point in which we have to face the hard decisions. That's why it's only logical that head of delegations will go back to capitals. They will expose to their authorities the situation, and they will come back, I hope, with new, fresh ideas to finally close the negotiations.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said although the sides have made good progress, some key issues still need to be resolved. Iran has demanded the removal of all sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled under the former US administration, saying it would only return to full compliance after the verification of sanctions removal.
It is certainly the other side who has to make difficult decisions. What we need to do at the same time is on the implementation plans, decide on the methods and ways which meet our interest most. But for the US, for the other side, for Europeans, it is time to make difficult decisions, and I hope that they would be able to do that.
The Joint Commission will meet again in a week's time, and though the EU coordinator said he is absolutely sure the next round will be the last, Iran's lead delegate opted for a more cautious stance, saying that nothing can be predicted in such difficult negotiations. Homal Eskip, Vienna.
Tehran says there has been no disruption in the Iranian oil production after a fire broke out in a refinery to the south of the country's capital. The oil minister, Bijan Zanganeh, said the incident at the Tehran oil refinery is under control. The official noted that the fire was related to a leakage of two tanks that had no role in the production process. Authorities say the fire is contained and the refinery is set to resume production from Thursday. No casualties were reported in the incident. Iran has launched an exclusive internet TV network for each of the seven candidates who are running in the 13th presidential elections due on June 18. Saman Kujuri reports.
With less than 3 weeks to the 13th presidential election in Iran, the race gets tighter among the seven candidates who are given equal airtime on Iran's national television to outline their plans. This year, the coronavirus pandemic has restricted election rallies and electoral tours. Based on the guidelines set by the Coronavirus Combat Committee, campaigning will revolve around televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. Accordingly, as per an approval by the country's election headquarters, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB, has launched internet TV networks for each presidential contender, with all the facilities to record, produce, and broadcast videos for domestic and international audience on internet protocol TVs, known as IPTVs.
Based on an approval by Iran's election headquarters, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting has launched internet TV networks for each presidential contender, with all the facilities to record, produce, and broadcast videos, establish live contacts, and establish contact with guests outside the studio, which airs programs for domestic and international audience on such internet protocol TV platforms such as Telewebian, Lens, and Tiwa. Therefore, an exclusive studio and free TV network has been provided for each one of the presidential candidates so as to express their views and plans equally for the presidential race.
Seven candidates are running in Iran's 13th presidential election due on June 18th. All of them have so far been focusing on the economy, battered by sanctions and mismanagement in recent years.
Aside from IPTVs for candidates, IRIB has also launched an internet network titled Vote, which has a collection of programs on election. Through launching such exclusive internet TV channels for each candidate, we give them equal timing of 24 hours a day, so as to be able to elaborate on their plans and views at a time when COVID-19 has prevented candidates from holding gatherings and electoral tours.
Although some of the contenders have stronger professional backgrounds, one cannot really tell who holds a better chance to win the top executive post before all candidates lay out their plans. Under the law, the Iranian presidential candidates will continue their election campaign until 24 hours before the polls open on June 18th. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
So Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's opponents have secured a coalition deal potentially putting an end to his 12-year rule. The opposition leader, Yair Lapid, has notified President Rivlin that he can form a power-sharing cabinet. The announcement came after the United Arab List Party joined the coalition. Lapid has spearheaded the efforts to form the coalition and managed to garner the backing of far-right politician Naftali Bennett. Under the deal, Bennett will serve as prime minister for 2 years before being replaced by Lapid for the second half of the term. Mona Kandil says the United Arab List Party has joined the Israeli anti-Netanyahu coalition to remove him from the political arena.
Lapid has formed the coalition cabinet with the help of Mansour Abbas. He's the head of the United Arab List. We have to say that there are Palestinians, Arabs, in the Israeli Knesset, those Palestinians who live in the lands occupied in 1948. Well, until the September 2019 election, the Palestinian legislators refused to take part in the political game. Throughout the years, the Arab Knesset members stood out mainly for the way they advocated on behalf of the Palestinian national agenda. But then this political issue the last past 2 years and the inability of Netanyahu to form a coalition cabinet, and there was a pressure to remove Netanyahu from the political arena. It seems that this time, this Arab Knesset member, Abbas Mansour, decided to join the coalition in order for, as experts are saying, to get rid of Netanyahu.
Now, the World Health Organization has warned of, quote, staggering health needs in the occupied Palestinian territories after last month's Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip. The WHO said the organization is scaling up its response to provide health aid for almost 200,000 people in need across the occupied territories, including in the West Bank. The WHO's Rick Pieperkorn called for unhindered access to humanitarian and development-related essential supplies and staff into Gaza and the referral of patients out of there whenever needed. Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has organized a mass rally in the Gaza Strip to celebrate the resistance front's victory against Israel's recent aggression on the impoverished enclave. Zerubbabel Shavit has more in this report.
Palestinians tooled to the streets of the Gaza Strip to celebrate their victory against the Israeli aggression. The Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine organized this rally, which included a military parade in honor of Abu Ali Mustafa brigades on the rubble of targeted buildings. Participants reiterated the strict position of defending Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
We are here today to tell the world that resistance is our only way to liberation. We celebrate our victory over this inhumane occupation that killed our children. Palestinians in all parts of Palestine, in Gaza, Sheikh Jarrah, and occupied lands remain committed to the resistance front. Palestinians have proved that they will not hesitate to defend Palestinian rights and Jerusalem al-Quds.
Palestinians held flags and banners praising the resistance against the Israeli regime. They also renewed their vows to keep the Palestinian resistance ongoing until all parts of Palestine are liberated.
We are celebrating this victory. Our resistance scared Netanyahu, who killed our children and destroyed our homes. We are getting closer more than ever to retaking our lands.
A series of events is held in the Gaza Strip as part of protests against Israel's plan to evict Sheikh al-Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem al-Quds.
People here are expressing their support for the Palestinian resistance. All Palestinians now view the resistance as their only way to defend Palestinian rights. Today, we are sending a clear message to the Israeli regime to leave our lands and Jerusalem al-Quds.
Hundreds of Palestinians were killed in the Israeli offensive, including women and children, and many others injured in Israeli onslaught on Gaza.
After an 11-day escalation on the Gaza Strip, Palestinians here celebrate their victory, vowing to remain their resistance against any violation of their rights. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
An Australian court has been presented with hundreds of photos of Aussie soldiers drinking from the prosthetic leg of a slain Afghan national. The photos were presented by lawyers for a soldier suing several media outlets for defamation. The photographs of Australian soldiers guzzling alcohol from the artificial limb were published in December 2020 and became graphic displays of alleged gross misconduct by Australian troops stationed in Afghanistan. A newspaper alleged in 2009 that a soldier shot dead an Afghan civilian and brought to the prosthetic leg as a, quote, souvenir. The defamation case against the Australian media was filed in response to a series of reports published in 2018 wherein the soldier was accused of war crimes, which his lawyers deny as baseless and false. The trial will begin in Sydney on June the 7th. Now, Tim Anderson is the director at the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies and joins us now. Tim, welcome. What's your views on this story and how do you think it will be received back home in Australia?
It's a very important story in Australia because it, as even some corporate journalists are recognizing now, the defamation case brought on by former soldier Ben Robert Smith, it's a prelude to possible prosecution of Robert Smith for war crimes in Afghanistan. And while he has the backing of one media billionaire, some of the other media chains are pressing that this case is able to be reported on freely. So it's initiated a conflict between media billionaires, all of whom normally support all of the wars in the Middle East, but they're at odds over this. And it's also called into question the entire role of Australian involvement in Afghanistan, which was considered, quote, the good war, unquote, compared to the other dirty wars in the region.
Well, this potentially, Tim, become like a symbol of, alleged impropriety, similar to what we saw with American troops in the Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, for example.
Yes, it's a parallel to that in the Australian context. Remember this man, Ben Robert Smith, who has been hired by one of the media networks by a billionaire who's heavily invested in Israel and supports the special air services that Roberts was part of. Roberts is the most highly decorated living Australian soldier. So he was, in a sense, an icon, a representative of the reason why Australian troops were in Afghanistan at all. Now, if he's disgraced as a war criminal involved in several murders, which has already been affirmed by an investigation by the Defence Department, so-called Brereton Report, which found over 30 murders of civilians by Australian soldiers, so that's all out in the public there. So the entire edifice and the image of the Australian involvement in the war in Afghanistan is at risk here, and it may be that the defamation case in advance of criminal charges is going to bring that to a much wider public and start to determine the matter in people's minds here.
Okay, Tim, always a pleasure speaking to you. Tim Anderson there, the director at the Centre for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us out of Sydney. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
China opened its first 5G-enabled fully automated port a year ago in Shenzhen, with automated cranes stacking containers on driverless trucks. Shanghai's Yangshan port began fully automated 24-hour operations in August of 2020. In late 2020, Shandong Energy Group began operations at an automated coal mine controlled by a 5G network. We have prepared for you an article written by David Goldman. The piece is titled US is Chasing China's Tail on 5G. The article has been published by the Asia Times. Thank you. According to China's industry leaders, the mainland's manufacturers have installed about 5,000 private fifth-generation networks and will add tens of thousands more this year as 5G broadband enables fourth industrial revolution applications. China already has 70% of the world's installed fifth-generation base stations and 80% of the world's 5G smartphone users. The global chip shortage and U.S. sanctions against Chinese telecommunications equipment firms such as Huawei and ZTE have slowed China's fifth-generation build-out to some extent, but fifth-generation infrastructure already covers all of China's major cities. According to industry sources, China will add between 500,000 to 800,000 new 5G base stations to the 792,000 in place at the end of February. 5G's impact on productivity as well as profitability will come from downstream applications, not the network build-out as such. One Chinese executive told Asia Times, "It doesn't make any sense for the West to pour billions of dollars into alternative to China's fifth-generation technology," adding, "It's too little too late, and it focuses on the wrong areas. Trying to invent an alternative ecosystem isn't going to work. I would have expected the United States to say, let's transform industry, let's be more competitive. As I argued in my 2020 book, You Will Be Assimilated, China's plan to Sinoform the world, fifth generation is the railroad of the 21st century. A carrier technology whose importance lies in the other technologies it makes possible. Every important railroad company founded in the 19th century went bankrupt, and the industry was unprofitable until Edward Henry Harriman, an American financier and railroad executive, reorganized the Union Pacific at the end of the century. But it launched America's industrial and agricultural revolutions. According to a semiconductor industrial executive, the speed of further fifth-generation build-out will depend in part on China's ability to manufacture chips with transistor gateways of 28 nanometers or less. Most observers believe that China has mastered 28 nanometer process node production and will be able to fabricate most of its own requirements by the end of 2021. Media attention has focused on the newest chips with gateways of 7 nanometers or even less. With power high-end smartphones, crypto mining workstations, and other high-powered devices. But the workhorse of semiconductor applications is the previous generation of chips in the 14 to 28 nanometer range, which will provide the bulk of the chip demand during the next 5 years, especially for wireless connectivity. In its drive for semiconductor self-sufficiency, China has concentrated on fabrication capacity and chip-making equipment in the 28-nanometer range. Shanghai Microelectronic Equipment will deliver the first Chinese-made lithography scanner using the deep ultraviolet DUV process in late 2021. Washington persuaded the Dutch government to stop the Netherlands firm ASML from selling China the extreme ultraviolet scanners required for 7-nanometer and smaller chip production. Only Taiwan and South Korea have the ability to make the narrower gateway chips. But China has been an important buyer of Dutch DUV machines and appears ready to deploy its own. Although U.S. carriers offer what they call fifth-generation service, the American version provides download speeds barely above the older generation 4G LTE broadband and around 60 megabits per second. The average speed in China is 5 times higher at over 300 megabits per second. Private networks support industrial robotics as well as smart logistics, including automation of major ports. A fifth-generation network supports the automation of the Shanghai port, which handles 44 million containers per year, compared to 8 million containers at America's largest facility in Long Beach, California, where more than 20 ships are waiting offshore to unload. China opened its first fifth-generation enabled fully automated port a year ago in Xiamen, with automated cranes stacking containers on driverless trucks. Shanghai's Yangshan port began fully automated 24-hour operations in August of 2020. In late 2020, Shandong Energy Group began operations at an automated coal mine controlled by a fifth-generation network. Automated warehouses, autonomous vehicles, and drones promise to transform e-commerce, with firms like Alibaba and JD Logistics offering same or next-day delivery from computer-controlled storage facilities where packages are sorted and sent by drones or autonomous vehicles. JD Logistics' $3.2 billion initial public offering launched in Hong Kong recently, promising a new level of productivity in delivery. JD Logistics still depends on 200,000 delivery personnel, but its warehouse management makes Amazon look primitive. According to a 2020 report by the Cape Gemini Research Institute, by contrast, Western companies are still evaluating whether they should install private fifth-generation networks to support factory automation. Some German companies, including Audi and BASF, are testing private networks. In May of 2021, Ericsson installed a private network for Airbus, Europe's premier manufacturer of civilian aircraft, but the network will run on fourth generation until the fifth generation network is launched next year. In Silicon Valley, Hitachi and Ericsson have built a fifth generation research network. With few exceptions, Western investment in enterprise fifth generation networks is tentative and experimental, while China's factories, mines, and ports have put fifth generation into full operation. The critical difference between fifth generation and older broadband isn't speed, but rather carrying capacity and latency or speed of response. Industrial operations require near instant response time among machines controlled by the network, and fifth generation, which reduces response time by a factor of 10, opens up possibilities for industrial automation that formerly were unimaginable. In 2019, I interviewed Huawei Chief Technology Officer Paul Scanlon for my book on China. Scanlon told me, the combination of machine learning and fifth generation will allow robots to talk to each other and work out production processes without the help of human engineers. Paul Scanlon told me, let's take robotics today. Fifth generation changes everything. Typically, 5G is spoken about in terms of download speed, but that's not the most important advantage. He added, for industrial processes, autonomous vehicles, and other applications, the latency, the time it takes for one device to acquire and respond to a signal from another device, is more important. On a factory floor today, robot A does its instruction, passes the bit to robot B, and it's the same thing. Paul Scanlon added, now, if we put very low latency inside each of the robots, and they can be robots from different manufacturers, and put them in a room, and give them the rules like Go or like chess to enable them to connect in real time, milliseconds, and lightning fast, then put a bit of plastic in view and say, I want you to make a plastic cup, the robots will organize themselves much better than we would have thought. Scanlan added, you're going to push the plastic flat. You're going to extrude it this way. You're going to finish it that way. That's the way we think, and that might be the first attempt of the robots, adding, then afterwards we can talk about cutting down the amount of wastage, or the time it takes to make these things, or other key performance indicators, and they will start to do things differently. Huawei's chief technology officer concluded by saying, what we saw when we did this in collaboration between robots from different manufacturers, ABB, Kawasaki and others, connectivity allows you to move from very basic stuff to very sophisticated stuff.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. We're proud to bring you this show only on IRB English Radio and, of course, in the studio as always. And, of course, in the studio, as always, I have my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Dear Zainab, happy to be here.
I'm totally excited to have you with us again so we can continue our active discussion. We were talking about criteria that a woman should possess in order to be a desirable, proper, decent spouse for her husband and a good mom for her children, and you know, build a good family with each other, inshallah ta'ala. Number one was submissiveness. No, number one was faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Number two was
not to be stubborn, to be good tempered.
And number three was submissiveness,
not to be selfish. Right. And actually, this is the submissiveness. So get it from the verse of the Quran, chapter Nisa, verse number 34. After Arjal Qawwamun al Nisa, was Salihat. Remember that righteous women are submissive.
Qanitatun.
Qanitat, exactly.
Hafidat.
So Hafidatun, Qanitatun, exactly. Yeah. And there's a beautiful, you know, nowadays some people have, you know, they have this negative view to religion that, like, yeah, if Islam has said you have to be submissive, that's like for 1,400 years ago, and like things have changed, you have to empower women.
That's such a backward mentality.
Exactly. But then, if you say that such a poet, like Hafiz or Sa'di, like such great poets have said this, like, they just remain quiet.
Or Jane Austen said it, or Charlotte Bronte said it.
Exactly.
Like, oh my God, that's so romantic.
I know, I know. And there was this beautiful poem from Sa'di, the great Iranian poet, describing a woman, a very good companion in life. So he says, you have to translate it. زن خوب فرمانبر پارسا کند مرد درویش را پادشاه.
A good, submissive, pious woman will turn
a dervish,
nobody of a husband, into a king.
Exactly. چو یاری موافق بود در برد, if you have a companion who is موافق with you, who is in your team, who is in your boat, who would say, no, I think what you said is wrong. You know, sometimes you see this. همه روز اگر غم خوری غم مدار.
Even if you are sorrowful every day.
If you come home from a, you know, from a world where it is against you, but then you come home to someone who is in your team, who is supporting you, right? Then don't worry, because the world is yours and you're the king of the world.
Exactly. There's actually a hadith too, I think hadith Qudsi. Hadith al-Qudsi, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells Nabi Musa ala nabina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, that verily when I want the good of this world and the hereafter for my servant, I grant them a good spouse.
Exactly.
There's another hadith that says, I grant them knowledge in religion. And there's another hadith that says, I grant them the love of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Mm. And then there's good spouse. So like these three are basically at the same level. Right. And that's so mind-blowing.
It is. It is so important. So that so when we're talking about the preconception stage, then it's like linked to the two chains are linked together to the pre-spouse selection, to the post-conception where you delivered the child. And in all these areas and phases of life, if you have a comrade, if you have a companion, you know, someone whom you can really know that you can lean on, you can have the support of that person, it makes the world so much more tolerable in the face of all these stresses and, you know, problems and chaos and everything happening.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Also, among the qualities that we have to avoid when choosing a spouse, I'm talking about a woman, is ladies or girls who are very boastful girls, who's like, yeah, you know, my father has this, and yeah, our house is over there, and when we were going on that trip to this country, we did this, and we spent this much money, and, you know, I bought this cell phone for this many dollars. This is my brand shirt, or my dress cost this much, and my birthday was like that, you know? So
constantly showing off.
Right. So they are supposed to be
avoided.
And we just say these, but I have one very practical example. Like I've seen a couple that she got married to a boy just because he was well off, and she thought that she will provide a very luxurious life for her, so that she will be able to boast to her friends. You know,
that's ridiculous.
This is it's the reality.
I've seen a lot of cases like this.
It's the reality.
The guy ended up being a very abusive, foul mouthed, ill-tempered, blasphemous, horrible, insensitive, inconsiderate, cheating douchebag.
Okay.
And they finally got a divorce when she was like 60 plus.
Wow.
Like she basically sucked him dry.
And of his money?
Yeah, and he abused her of every ounce of sanity she had. And their children are walking, talking, ticking time bombs, ready to have a mental breakdown at any given moment.
I understand.
Funnily enough, their children got divorced too.
I understand.
And like 40 years into the marriage, when the guy was over 70 and the woman was over 60, they broke each other in every way they knew how, and then they got separated. And I was just like sitting there scratching my head. And I'm like, this defeats the objective of everything. I don't know why y'all just did that.
So such simple facts, but look at the consequence.
Exactly.
You know, it's like one small stone you put in water, but the waves, it just goes far, right?
Exactly.
Or girls who are not so popular or who are infamous in their family. Like, you know, to say, this girl's like, you know, she has issues.
Uh-huh.
So like, when you are after a spouse, you should this shows that you have the importance of research, and that she has displayed her personality, especially in front of her relatives.
Oh, so one who's not beloved in the eyes of her relatives. Right? Because that's really important, and we have to look at the relatives too, because like if a girl She herself is a practicing individual, and she lives in a non-practicing family environment. Of course, you might not be that favored. She might not be popular.
Yeah.
But as long as she's loved by them, you know?
Right.
She has really good morals and a good behavior. You can be in contrast.
Exactly.
In, like, belief system contrast with your family, but still loved by them.
Exactly.
Because
you're
a good person.
This is very important. Mm. And
so number one was a woman who's boastful, who likes showing off. Number two is one who's not beloved by her family.
Right.
And number three?
Stubbornness.
Oh, my.
You know, we stubbornness is somehow, it's related to, like, not being submissive, right?
Right.
I think there's, like, a close relationship.
Absolutely.
Right? Because if you're only thinking of what you think is right, then why should you accept what the others are saying, right?
I pray to God, my heart, soul, and body, every single day of my life, with every breath. I solemnly promise to try to live my life for you. Oh, love, you did revive my soul and show new light into my heart. So please leave you, is now my only goal. Oh, I love you so, I love you so.
Also, we have the hadith to avoid greenery in a sewage, which means that, like, let's say the girl herself, she's, like, so beautiful and, like, she's
charismatic.
Yeah, and she's so, like,
beautiful figure.
You would just fall in love with her personality. And then she's in, like, such a family that you just explained that the marriage of the couple was wrong, and they lived with each other for 40 years. And in this environment she was raised up, so then what do you expect?
Exactly, right? She's messed up, broken, she's dysfunctional,
you see how
so
much
scarred, she's mentally manipulated and distorted. It's horrible.
So we have to be careful that when we are choosing, when we are helping our young ones, our children to get married, we have to look at the family that they are going to enter, because it's not just like two people meeting each other and then, like, uniting. It's like two families uniting. So it's really important that you pay attention to the qualities of that family as well.
Yeah, we're almost out of time. Actually, we're officially out of time.
Okay.
I think to like open a parenthesis regarding this family part, this kind of doesn't, there's the one exception to this, and it's the case of reverts.
Yeah.
If you're marrying a revert, doesn't matter how messed up their family is, I think they need a new family.
Yeah.
You know, but it's really hard, though.
Yeah, but these reverts, I mean, you know, sometimes there's a revert in a very good family. Like,
true.
So it's like sometimes a Christian or like a non-Muslim family raises their children up so beautifully.
Better than 100.
Better than exactly. So you can't really, the revert is like, I think she's to be treated just like any normal kind of
issue.
Yeah,
it's right.
The family is important. Mm. Like, it doesn't have to do with, of course, Islam is the religion that gives you lifestyle, and all these codes of behavior and values are embedded in this package of Islam. But Islam is based on fitrah, and fitrah is, you know, we're talking about a human. All humans in the world know that like a peaceful family environment where there's conformity between the spouses. So it's like a global thing, international thing. It doesn't really matter if you're Muslim or not. Of course, Islam facilitates this process of harmony in the family, but if your child falls in love with a non-Muslim family, of course that individual himself or herself is a Muslim, I think that's not a big issue.
Yeah, exactly.
If the family is sane.
All right, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Thank you all for being with us. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Astronomers and physicists have been trying to puzzle out the ultimate fate of the solar system for at least hundreds of years. Astronomers John Zink of University of California at Los Angeles and Konstantin Batygin of Caltech and Fred Adams of the University of Michigan in their new paper wrote, "Understanding the long-term dynamical stability of the solar system constitutes one of the oldest pursuits of astrophysics, tracing back to Isaac Newton himself, who speculated that mutual interactions between planets would eventually drive the system unstable. but that's a lot trickier than it might seem. The greater the number of bodies that are involved in a dynamical system interacting with each other, the more complicated that system grows and the harder it is to predict. This is called the n-body problem. Because of this complexity, it's impossible to make deterministic predictions of the orbits of solar system objects past certain timescales. Beyond about 5 to 10 million years, certainly flies right out of the window. But if we can figure out what's going to happen to our solar system, that will tell us something about how the universe might evolve, and timescales far longer than its current age of 13.8 billion years. The article has been written by Michelle Starr. The piece is titled Solar System Going to Totally Disintegrate Sooner Than We Thought. The article has been published in the Astronomical Journal. Although the ground beneath our feet feels solid and reassuring, nothing in this universe lasts forever. One day, our sun will die, ejecting a large proportion of its mass, before its core shrinks down into a white dwarf, gradually leaking heat until it's nothing more than a cold, dark, dead lump of rock, 1,000 trillion years later. But the rest of the solar system will be long gone by then. According to new simulations, it will take just 100 billion years for any remaining planets to skedaddle off across the galaxy, leaving the dying sun far behind. Astronomers and physicists have been trying to puzzle out the ultimate fate of the solar system for at least hundreds of years. Astronomer John Zink of the University of California at Los Angeles, Konstantin Batygin of Caltech, and Fred Adams of University of Michigan in their new paper have written, "Understanding the long-term dynamical stability of the solar system constitutes one of the oldest pursuits of astrophysics, tracing back to Isaac Newton himself, who speculated that mutual interactions between planets would eventually drive the system unstable. But that's a lot trickier than it might sound. The greater the number of bodies that are involved in a dynamical system interacting with each other, the more complicated the system grows and the harder it is to predict. This is called the n-body problem. Because of this complexity, it's impossible to make deterministic predictions of the orbits of solar system objects past certain timescales. Beyond about 5 to 10 million years, certainly flies right out of the window. But if we can figure out what's going to happen to our solar system, that will tell us something about how the universe might evolve on timescales far longer than its current age of 13.8 billion years. In 1999, astronomers predicted that the solar system would slowly fall apart over a period of at least a billion billion, that is 10 to the power 18, or a quintillion years. They calculated that's how long it would take for orbital resonances from Jupiter and Saturn to decouple Uranus. According to Zink's team, though, this calculation left out some important influences that could disrupt the solar system much sooner. Firstly, there's the sun. In about 5 billion years, as it dies, the sun will swell up into a red giant, engulfing Mercury, Venus, and even Earth. Then it will eject nearly half its mass, blown away into space on stellar winds. The remaining white dwarf will be around just 54% of the current solar mass. This mass loss will loosen the sun's gravitational grip on the remaining planets. Mars and the outer planets and ice giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Secondly, the solar system orbits the galactic center. Other stars ought to come close enough to perturb the planet's orbits. around once every 23 million years. The researchers wrote, by accounting for stellar mass loss and the inflation of the outer planet orbits, these encounters will become more influential, adding, given enough time, some of these flybys will come close enough to dissociate or destabilize the remaining planets. With these additional influences accounted for in their calculations, the team ran the 10 N-body simulations for the outer planets, leaving out Mars to save on computation costs, since its influence should be negligible, using the powerful Shared Hoffman 2 cluster. These simulations were split into two phases, up to the end of the Sun's mass loss and the phase that comes afterwards. Although 10 simulations isn't a strong statistical sample, the team found that a similar scenario played out each time. After the Sun completes its evolution into a white dwarf, the outer planets have a larger orbit but still remain relatively stable. However, Jupiter and Saturn become captured in a stable 5-2 resonance. For every 5 times Jupiter orbits the Sun, Saturn orbits twice. That eventual resonance has been proposed many times, not least by Isaac Newton himself. These expanded orbits, as well as characteristics of the planetary resonance, make the system more susceptible to perturbations by passing stars. After 30 billion years, such stellar perturbations jangle those stable orbits into chaotic ones, resulting in rapid planet loss. All but one planet escape these orbits, fleeing off into the galaxy as rogue planets. The last lonely planet sticks around for another 50 billion years, but its fate is sealed. Eventually, it too is knocked loose by the gravitational influence of passing stars. Ultimately, by 100 billion years after the Sun turns into a white dwarf, the solar system is no more. That's a significantly shorter time frame than that proposed back in 1999. And researchers carefully note it's contingent on current observations of the local galactic environment and stellar flyby estimates, both of which may change. So it's by no means engraved in stone. However, even if the estimates of the timeline of the solar system's demise do change, it's still many billions of years away. The likelihood of humanity surviving long enough to see it is very slim.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.